This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hong, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. How are the doctors doing this evening?
Just good. Swell. How are you, Nate?
I'm doing good. Well, spring is in the air, and I guess Groundhog Day was just recently, so apparently spring is coming soon. So that's Dr. Lyle's, that tradition seems to have been around for a long time in our ancestry.
I didn't realize that was the word this year. I thought the deal was that the groundhog always told us that more winter was coming. It was all just kind of a interpretive dance around the groundhog's behavior.
Someone paid off the groundhog this day, and it wasn't me, but...
Oh, well, outstanding. That's really good news, then.
Six more weeks of winter down there in Los Angeles, Nathan. Going to be in the high 60s.
I've got my jacket on as we speak.
It's terrible. All right. It's not fit for human habitation.
Well, we have a question about standing outside in the winter time at 60 mm-hmm. degrees. Well, actually, it's minus 10 degrees a little bit later. But our first question this evening is for both doctors. So, dear doctors, I understand from evolutionary psychology that certain market distortions, like a large number of females in college or a small number of males in elderly age, affects the quality of partners that we are willing to date. Mm-hmm. What I'm not sure about is how this calibration changes subjective experience. Do people only change their behavior to attain a partner, or do they also feel more attracted to people of perhaps lesser gene quality?
It's a really good question, but it's such a bizarre amalgam of 20th, first century data analytics and the Stone Age. In other words, in history, you never knew what the base rates were. So nobody was telling you, oh, guess what? You're 70-year-old woman now. You're pretty well screwed.
Yeah, you knew the base rate in your village, but that was a pretty limited, data selection.
Yeah. So the answer is that people don't know the stats. All they know is their subjective experience. So I suppose some bizarre, incredibly left-brained data head could somehow railroad over their internal experience and say, you know what? The truth of the matter is I'm a 72-year-old female. That means my odds are horrendous. Therefore, Horace over there, who I find has almost no appeal, the fact that he has any at all, I better just take it. This is not happening. So the way it works is that the base rates that you're surrounded by, as well as the base rates that are circulating around in your head from your memory systems, these things are all put together in an amalgam of that sets goals for you with respect to any competitive enterprise. So when it comes to mates, friends, or trading partners, so let's get it out of the romance arena for just a minute, and let's use it a little bit differently. So let's suppose that you got your first job and you made $20,000 a year. Then the next you got a raise, you got to 30, then you got to 40, and then by the time you were 40 years old, you got yourself to $50,000. Okay, so now there's a mild recession and there's a cutback at your work. And It's and let's suppose that, you know, they liked you and everything, but they had to cut you. And so now you're unemployed. So now somebody comes along and says, well, you know, a competitor says, you know what, we'll pick you up. But we can give you $40,000. So now, you know, you're not wild about it, but you're real interested. And then another competitor says, you know, we can give you $47,000. Now you're pretty happy about that. Okay, why? Because you've now sort of seen the marketplace, you've calibrated, and now you're actually pretty excited about 47 because the alternative was 40, and other than that, it was unemployed. So you don't need to know what's happening in the whole market at all. You just need to know what's happening for you and a sense of what the base rates are out there. You really can't get excitement or non-excitement about anything unless you have some semblance of your own chances with respect to some asset, you know, obtaining an asset or losing it. So that's how it works. You're designed by nature to have your nervous system constantly updating what your expectation should be. It wouldn't work very well otherwise. Okay, so actually had a client worrying about their child and wanted to hold their child back a year in order to give their child greater advantages as they would go through all the grades. And the conversation was kind of entertaining as we talk about this. And the notion that was sort of rattling around inside the skull of the parent was, if I could get my child to have essentially more wins, then they're going to have more confidence. And if they're going to have more confidence, then somehow when they're swaggering around when they're in their 20s, they're going to wind up with fancier mating opportunities than they would have otherwise. And and therefore, if they get a 10% fancier mate, then I wind up with a 5% fancier grandchild. Now, that's not what consciously the person was thinking, but that is in principle exactly what they were thinking. And what the reason why this doesn't fly is because what's going to happen in the person's 20s is going to be a dynamic of the current marketplace. They're not going to be carrying forward a confidence that will not be dynamic. How much confidence they have or don't have is going. They may experience more confidence in their process from year to year if they're a little bit older and a little bit bigger, stronger, more developed, a little bit smarter, whatever it is. They may feel that at the time, but that confidence will all go entirely down the drain as soon as the circumstances change. So everybody that has ever gone to a fancy university and taken, you know, introductory biology
right.
or calculus knows this.
Yes,
okay,
exactly, like, the comparison I was thinking of, like take the first day of any class of my PhD program where you had the top of the class from every undergraduate institution all coming together in the grad program. It's like everybody's suddenly insecure for the first time in their life. It's like, oh God, yeah. Do I actually stand a chance of getting a B in this class? Like this is horrifying.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing to me how similar this is to business, because yeah. I remember my dad was to tell me, he says, you know, no matter how good of a business you used to be, if you are not currently providing a good mm-hmm. product or service, no one cares. You know,
yeah.
So
yeah, right. You're only as good as your last sale.
Maybe the last 2 years.
Right. If you can dump it on the next sucker before they ask for the quarterly report for year three. So
right.
Correct. Okay. This is actually why, by the way, I call my website and my approach to all this, and now I say me, but it's also Jen and my friend Rick Seidel. As psychologists, we're going to call this, if I can call Jen a psychologist, which I do call Jen a psychologist, even though in theory she's slightly other kind of species.
I didn't go to shrink school, so, but I do play a psychologist
right.
on TV, so it's okay.
It's the same thing. So that's why we call it esteem dynamics. It's the point to this is that esteem processes are always dynamic. So the feeling that the little kid has all the way might be great to have him, you know, lording it over other kids by an additional 10%. But as soon as the game changes, nobody really cares. And what the mating dynamics will be will not be derivative of what that person's experience was before. Okay? So every young kid that scrambles around and tries to make an NFL team knows this. That kid was an absolute superstar in college. Got drafted in the NFL in the sixth round and barely beat somebody out to make, you know, the practice squad the first year. Made a good salary doing it, but it's like, oh my God, the attitude is suddenly, I'm too good to be anything other than the quarterback, to, hey, you know, I'll change the water buckets and hopefully I get in to be a guy that can be on the kickoff team. Okay, calibration. So the calibration processes are always inherently dynamic. They certainly will carry a residual of the past for a good reason. And that is that the past could recur. There are, you know, so if it turned out that you were once worth $50,000, then there's a very good chance that that's going to happen again, even if you go through a recession and a dip. Okay, so that's how this is going to work. So in the mating arena, if we go back to the mating arena for the question, what's going to happen is we're always looking through the lens, and the way the systems will work is they're always looking through the lens of the person's subjective experience. So they don't say, oh, well, it's a lousy market situation, so therefore, you know, I don't want this person, but I'll just take it for a mate. I mean, some people might do such a thing that are very needy and would somehow see almost no positive feelings towards some specific mate, but will take one because why? Because it rids them of some really big time loneliness that they would otherwise have. That's certainly possible to some degree, but even then, you're looking at a complex CB that's responding to market dynamics. So in general, the big answer is that these things that are happening wordlessly, unconsciously, and automatically in calibration systems. So I've also been very interested in this. There's been sociologists that have looked at this kind of data analysis through the lens of essentially mating competition over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And I have never analyzed the... Jen, you might know more about this in political science because that I'm sure there's been poli-sci data heads that have done similar things in politics. But one of the things that's interesting is sort of if there are lesser females relative to males in a given period of time, it appears that the males, that marriage rates go up. Mm-hmm. It's like the guys feel the pressure. They can't play the field. Okay.
Right.
And when there's more females relative to the males, suddenly the males are less likely to marry. So it appears that, you know, there's no way that some guy's got a protractor and a calculator in his pocket trying to decide. This is all happening because the subjective dynamics, as people respond to rejection and acceptance cues and have excitement versus less excitement versus no excitement over options, this is all being driven by the subtlest of market dynamics that flow through a population and impact an individual's set of opportunities.
That's wonderful. Now, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, do you have any insight as to how long, you know, or a recalibration might take? For example, this is actually what I'm thinking. Let's say I date a woman who's way out of my league to the positive. So I'm very over rewarded and date her for long enough to where she realizes I'm the over rewarded one, breaks up, dumps me. And then, mm-hmm. And then the next girl that I'm going to be looking for is I'm going to have to get recalibrated till I real, you know, to the marketplace. Is there a time frame for that? I mean, is that, that you've seen in your experience? 6 months, 5 years, 10 years, maybe never, depending on how over
the
world. I think
you're ruined for life.
the thing is that the, your attractiveness mechanisms, in other words, the things that you find attractive, are really not going to change. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're still picking up, you know, sexualized characteristics, and they're still you have innate systems that are designed to signal excitement or cause excitement if you see, feel, touch, hear, etc. Those stimuli. The only question is now, how are you going to behave with respect to the sort of pair bond casual mating strategy dynamic around those things? So that's a little bit of a different story, and that's where I believe your recent experience would make a difference. In other words, you would still some young lady that you would have been interested in getting your hands on, Nathan. Wolf that you are.
My smile.
My
smile is more
masculinity
like
masculinity alarm. It's time to break it out again. You guys have been well behaved for a while, but that was beyond the pale.
Point is that same individual, just because you were over rewarded for a while, will still cause those same essential visceral reactions. But you may be harder to negotiate with. And so that's, and that may last just, I don't think that those are likely to have a lot of stickiness to them. In other words, there's nothing about the one market experience of being overawarded that's going to be any stickier than the next time when this girl that you would like, but if she's putting up more barriers to you, and you're seeing the barriers, and you're a little irritated because you're thinking, "Hey, well, wait a second. Haven't you seen? You know, don't you know the law of transitivity? Didn't you go to high school? Didn't you do some high school math?" Okay, yeah. Can I show you the picture of the girl that sort of just dumped me, but I sort of dumped her, and it was sort of mutual? Okay, so the thing is that she's not caring about that transitivity. She cares about her own assessment of you, et cetera. And so she's going to play her own game, and you're going to find out that person's feedback is just as important as the other girl's feedback. Okay? Why would our nervous system be so transfixed by the beauty queen's feedback and not by this other person who qualifies importantly on to a certain degree, but not as spectacularly? Her feedback is also going to be important. So the point is that your nervous system is constantly updating and readjusting. I have found myself subjectively on this very question, watching my own internal confidence and feelings in a matter of an hour. So the point is that, yeah, the answer is that these things are highly dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, I think of the pleasure trap where, you know, if you're eating highly stimulating foods, you know, and it might take a 1 to 3 months for your taste buds to recalibrate if you, you know, if you deprive yourself of the highly stimulating food. And, you know, so I was wondering if there's such a similar, you know, conceptual thing with dating and other things.
Really interesting. That's a great question and analogy, and the answer, I believe, would be no. So the supernormal stimuli and the defense of the essentially neurological architecture to try to defend against that is not going to be the same thing as a market calibration phenomenon. Market calibration phenomenon would be much faster.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So it's faster than... Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, believe me. Like, you might take 6 weeks so that before you can eat an apple without candy on the top of it. But in 4 days, when you get the pink slip, you're going to be recalibrated to what you're worth.
Mm-hmm.
And so no, it's not going to take. This is not a hard recalibration problem. The system's designed by nature for accuracy and it's gonna move pretty quickly to try to triangulate on whatever the truth is.
Okay. Yeah, in my mind, I was thinking of, and I know this is a completely different topic altogether, but in my mind, I was thinking of the TV trope of the broken person after a breakup. They're like, I'll never date anybody again, and for 6 months, they're wallowing, and 1 year, they're wallowing. Obviously, it's the, you know, they've got to roll up the shirt sleeves, but that's kind of what was in my mind about, you know, is there a calibration mechanism for you know, dating? But that's
That's actually a little different situation. And that is that if someone is hanging on to something where they were temporarily over rewarded and in a relationship and then they got dumped, a reason why they'll hang on isn't that they're now miscalibrated. It's that they're a lot of times scheming and hoping that it's going to return, which would have happened a lot in the Stone Age. So that's going to a lot of times dissuade them from getting into a new relationship that's not as fancy, just because, hey, they want to be available. Okay. So yeah, I think that's a little more complicated situation. That's what I'm thinking. Jen, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very likely, when something like that is going on, it's because you're scheming and hoping that the person's going to go out there and attempt to find other options and fail and slink back to you eventually. I think that's a very common interpretation of that. I think also sometimes that can be a little bit ego trap behavior. So people have, you know, are despairing of ever finding anyone who is as fancy as the person that they've lost. And so they just decide to kick over the table and, well, I'm just going to sit here and eat ice cream and play the role of the wronged partner. And I'm not even going to go back out there on the market and screw it. So there's definitely some of that going on in a lot of cases as well. I'm still sort of thinking there's something more to think through on the earlier question with the, I totally see where you're coming from with the, you know, nobody is permanently miscalibrated. It just becomes a matter of, you know, at what point do you assign pair bond value to another applicant rather than casual mating value? And I think that works differently for women than it does for men to some degree. And we'd have to think through that a little more. But just because women are not as inherently interested in casual mating just generally, and they're definitely not making that initial just physical value assessment as the, you know, bulk of the mate value. So I think when women and men have interacted and had a relationship with a unicorn, it affects them differently.
Right.
And the bar remains set at a very high level. And for men, that can just mean, okay, well, you know, the next applicant who comes along that's not a unicorn, still interesting, just not going to be pair bond material. But for women, it's like, well, why bother? If it's not, if you're not dealing with very fancy genes, but you've had a unicorn who did qualify, you know, this non-fancy new applicant is certainly not worth a casual mating strategy. So it's the threshold remains recalibrated at a higher level for women who are more pair oriented, as most women
that's
are.
That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, that would be my feeling about what's going on there, and just my own experience, and also that of a lot of women that I've talked to as clients and as, you know, friends over ice cream and pajamas after a breakup. Vegan ice cream, of course.
That's really interesting. That's great. That's a whole. That is the other side of that mountain. Very good.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Cool. Right. Let's go on. What else we got, Nathan?
What else is happening?
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, when I was in my 20s, I used to go to bars and wait in line to get in during the winter. In Montreal, winters can be very cold, minus 10, minus 20 degrees. But I would always see girls waiting in the cold without proper clothing. And these happen to be the sexiest girls. My buddy would be impressed with them, saying that they seemed to have a supernatural ability to beat the cold. I wasn't so impressed because I knew that they wanted to send a message, and that message was that. I was not so impressed because I knew that they wanted to send a message, and that no one is immune to cold. Besides, I knew that we had no chance with these girls, and that most of the time they were smoking, which I really abhor. My question is, do you think that exhibiting the capacity to sustain a noxious stimulus can be used as a gene quality signal? And do you think that smoking can also be viewed in this way? It's obviously a pleasure trap, but maybe smokers want to send the signal, well, look how high quality my genes are. I can get away with smoking with impunity.
Hmm. Oh, this sounds like my adolescence, so I'll go ahead and take this one on.
Sure.
I grew up in Alaska, which was very cold, and I clearly remember the day that I basically got the memo that all the hot girls did not feel the cold at all. So it was definitely a signal. It was a very important signal when you were waiting for the bus. This was probably, we were probably 10 or 11 years old when this happened, that your popularity and your success in that middle school was directly proportional to how resistant to wearing snow pants in the winter you were, even if it was 40 below outside. So this was very much understood among everybody. And I remember like remarking on it. I actually remember, I will not out her by name, but I remember her name. I remember waiting at the bus stop with this one very popular girl who was, you know, just wearing a short skirt and bare legs on a day that was, it was probably 20 below Fahrenheit. So it was, and she, you know, was completely unbothered, just got on the bus. It was all cool. No problem. She had a little light jacket on. And, you know, the 10, 11 year old female brain is going, is chunking through that going, okay, well, that's required to be cool. That's required to be sexy and popular. So noted. Okay. Got that logged away. I think that is a different process than smoking. So the question is about, you know, noxious stimuli and whether that's a gene quality signal. I think definitely displaying to the village that you can withstand the cold is definitely, my genes are very superior. Check me out. You know, you want to mate with me, even though I'm 10 years old, but you know, eventually that this is definitely a presentation of higher gene quality. I think what's happening with the smoking is that later in high school, all those same girls are congregating in the smoking section around all the Jimmies. So it's not the proximity, it's not the noxious stimulus of the nicotine or the smoke. It's the proximity to the Jimmies, because the Jimmies are all smoking. So, and I, at some point in my travels, I came across some suggestive little study that was really self-evident and obvious, but at least they went to the effort to research it and document it, which is that women are reading risky behavior from men as a casual mating signal, so that men who are drinking or who are smoking or who are daredevils on their motorcycles are more likely to be interpreted by the female brain as open to casual mating. I know this is shocking, but you know, they actually demonstrated this with some data.
How about competitive ping pong? Does that count? Did they have that in the study?
I'm sure that has a market, Horace. So I think
haven't found a woman yet at the ping pong place, though. So hold out for it.
just keep working on it. She's out there. So I think with what you're seeing in smoking sections outside of bars or outside of high schools or anywhere in the cold is this combination of things. So you have these women who are displaying superior gene quality by their amazing immunity to the cold that they want you to believe that they have. And also just the, you know, they're showing off more skin as part of that. So it's part of the display that is a helpful addition to that whole process. And they're hanging out with the smokers because the smokers are more likely to be open to casual mating. And they're Jimmies, and so they're just inherently more interesting because Jimmies are more likely to be smokers. And then they are exposing themselves to a pleasure trap process. So many of them are going to become smokers themselves. That's what I think would be happening there. Not that they are smoking as a way to signal superior gene quality per se, but that it's all coming kind of bundled together in a larger sexual display. That's my interpretation of probably what's going on there. Doug might have other thoughts, though.
Yeah, no, that all sounds pretty square to me. The one thing that strikes me as a note that would be open for discussion is whether or not the female exposure to cold is an unconscious display of genetic superiority. Let me tell you why that, in other words, I believe they're wanting to show skin or that they're wanting to show body contours. Okay.
Right. They're
and
definitely,
so I think that,
They're doing both, I think.
Yes.
And I think it's context dependent. I think when you're in in a cold place where everybody else is very bundled up, that it's showing off that you're a little, just like, hey, I can drink with the boys, you know, I can keep up. I can drink just as much beer as you can. It's a similar sort of like, I'm again a testosterone cue, i.e. more casual mating. So it's a display of availability to casual mating in addition to the proximity with the Jimmies. Yeah. You're also showing that you're tougher. So being tougher translates to more testosteronized, translates to more open to casual mating.
Yeah, I think I can see, let's just talk about this for just a minute. Because, you know, I've been in a swanky nightclub place once for about 15 minutes. They must have not had a cover charge. Okay. I don't remember. I think it was in San Francisco. I know it had to have been. So, and it was cold outside. And, you know, I've certainly been downtown where you'll see, you know, lines of 100 people waiting to get in. You're going to see females in short skirts, you know, and it's 40 degrees outside. So my thinking is that these are females that are absolutely, totally determined to display. Mm-hmm. So they're very competitive in this arena, and they they know that that the right move is to show a bunch of skin, minimum amount of clothes, show off contours, etc. That these are major league casual mating strategy displays, and the I think though that it's. I don't think they're trying to get extra points for how tough they are to stand up to the cold. I think they're just absolutely determined to not subtract points from putting any clothes on.
Yeah, so and they're waiting outside, which means they haven't been let in. So if they put on clothes, then the bouncer may not even let them in.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So, that's a very true.
So they're self-selecting out.
Studio 54. Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely that applies in the case of adult women outside a nightclub in San Francisco, for sure.
Yes.
I think that is all about, you know, how much skin can I show off, and I'm just going to tough it out and shiver and it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
But I do, just as someone who grew up in a very cold place where, you know, I experienced these dynamics firsthand and felt that sort of impulse to show off some superior gene quality that was definitely associated with an immunity to an ever-present environmental factor that was, you know, affecting other people more than it affected me. So I was more resilient to it.
I can see that. Actually, I can see that more of a phenomenon in a place like Alaska.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it's very context.
No, I understand that. Now that actually makes sense to me. So that now I see why you're saying that, and I see how absolutely that could be true. As a young boy, you could also want to show how tough you were against the cold in Alaska. You could see the same kind of thing.
Oh, and they do.
Right, but you wouldn't be seeing that at 40 degrees outside the thing in San Francisco. The guy just is wanting to look cool as hell. He's not really trying to show. So yeah, no. Now I think we're converging on similar thinking there. So now I'm happier. Good.
Yeah, like Seattleites, Seattleites who refuse to carry an umbrella.
Thank you for a woman splaining that to both of to Dr. Lyle and to me.
Yes.
Oh, happy to femsplain anytime. just sit back and make a mug of tea while I tell you how it is, boys.
That's beautiful.
Dr. Lyle had his first experience with mansplaining recently.
Oh,
I forget.
Do tell.
I know I did, but
your sister mansplained to you because she's probably the only human on the planet who you would allow to actually mansplain to you.
She did. She absolutely did. That's right. Perfect.
Yep. Yeah.
All right.
It's good that we're all catching up with modern times here.
Good. All right.
All right.
Let's.
All right. Our next question.
Soldier on. All right. Nathan.
I am an introverted married woman in my mid-40s. I have a friend who's single and in her early 60s. She frequently asks me and a small covey of women who all happen to have mates to go out dancing, to dinner, etc. via group texts. As I refuse to go to nightclubs, I occasionally join them for dinners, maybe twice a year, but I refuse to go to nightclubs. My question is, does a woman increase her chances of finding a mate if she surrounds herself with other women? Is she attempting to create a lure of some sort? I don't want to continue to be uncooperative about assembling with the group if this is something that could potentially increase her chances at finding someone. Any insight into this would be greatly appreciated.
Well, first of all, her chances of finding a mate have to do with a multitude of things, and her increasing her chances had to do with her displaying her attractiveness, working on her attractiveness, fishing where the fish are, and et cetera. Okay, and working on getting herself calibrated so that some poor Horace may qualify. So the issue with our questioner is relationships in principle are built around time spent together where it is mutually enjoyable or profitable. So the time that we spend with a friend doing something we don't want to do because it might be the friend's benefit, that's a price to a relationship that in principle we don't want to be paying. And so I think of relationships as Venn diagrams, and where with their an intersection of mutual interests where it is profitable to expend your time and energy in those mutually gratifying pursuits. That when we start to push the envelope and increase the overlap between the two diagrams, then we can turn something from highly profitable to a lot less profitable. And so in principle, my attitude would be, don't do anything you don't want to do. Okay, so that's where I come down. Now you might say, well, now wait a second. Should that be a hard and fast rule? No, because if a little bit of hassle on my part would save Jen a tremendous amount of time and energy, then it's an important trade. It's a friendship process where, and then hopefully, you know, if that were true, there would be a big gratitude signal from Jen, and I'd be delighted to not only get that signal, but delighted to be helpful, knowing that I had been helpful. But those shouldn't be the heart and soul of how things are organized. Those are going to be, you know, periodic opportunities that are going to be reciprocal. This problem of this woman finding a mate isn't going to happen because one more better looking than her woman joins her in the group bar. And so therefore, maybe some who on earth is going to run that gauntlet, go over there and signal to her. Like, how is this all going to happen? All right? No, she needs to be on Match.com or eHarmony.com, or she needs to set up a little thing at a car show saying that knows all about Mustangs so that all the old guys can talk to her.
Ooh, that's a good
She has to find some fishing mechanism that's going to work for her.
Mansplained about Mustangs. Boy, that sounds like my fondest dream. Just like, where do I sign up for that?
All right. But the point is here that this comes under the category of not your problem. And don't make it your problem to the detriment of burning hours of your life, you know, with this. Doesn't make any sense.
Walking through my own thought process on this. So it's not necessarily me arguing with you, but So like when I was reading this question, I thought, well, twice a year, mathematization of misery for the benefit of staying into friends, staying in a friend group so that when you get invited to, you know, dinners or parties or, you know, not huge parties like, you know, nightclubs, but, you know, just little get togethers where now you increase your chances of finding other, other mates. What's your thoughts on my thought process there?
Well, I can't even follow it. So we've now whittled this thing down to twice a year.
Yeah. And the question, she said she joins them for dinners maybe twice a year, but she refuses to go to nightclubs.
Oh, okay. Well,
at that point, I mean, do you want to go to those dinners twice a year? I mean, if it's some price, then why are we doing it in the first place?
Right.
If we can't handle it. Go ahead. Go ahead, Jen.
Yeah, I think some of it also, what I heard in the question was like, is there enough of an advantage to her friend in terms of finding a potential mate by having other women around, you know, it's kind of a fish trick question, you know, if you're surrounded by women more attractive than you, are you more likely to be approached in that nightclub? And therefore is the CB on showing up twice a year to facilitate that process worthwhile? But I think even if it were, and it probably would be, you know, it probably would work to that extent if you're kind of acting as a wing woman for your friend and luring in some bait.
A wing bitch.
But you're just luring in casual mating.
Yeah, right.
You said it. I didn't. You're just luring in casual mating heartbreakers. So they're gonna come in. It's a nightclub scene. This is all casual mating all the way. Your poor naive friend is gonna get, you know, sucked into this whole process and get ghosted, and then it's like rinse, repeat this cycle. So that goes back to the general advice that she should be on Match.com, God forbid, or one of the other
E-Harmony.
Websites. EHarmony, some paid website. This is what I keep telling all of my women clients is that, you know, require the guy to at least make a tiny bit of provision to show up on this website. Like, get off of Tinder, get off of OkCupid. These are free casual mating markets. So at least if he's paying $50 a month to be on the website, he's making a slight provisioning effort to be there. So you have a better chance of finding men who are interested in pair bonding, at least in principle. At a nightclub, if you're fish tricking and trying to pull somebody in with casual mating signals, like, this is a disaster waiting to happen. So especially if it's a bit of a burden to your CB to show up and to come out and go to the thing to start with, even if it is only a couple times a year. So if it's fun and you enjoy it and it's a social activity that, you know, provides some additional benefit beyond that, then by all means, go for it. But otherwise, yeah, not worth it.
I'm an introvert. I vote no.
Says the introvert, yes. Says the introvert who just told us he's only been to one nightclub ever one time.
Now, Dr. Hawk, it's been probably about 180 episodes since Dr. Lyle told us what the fish trick was. Can you tell us in your words what the fish trick is?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly why it's called the fish trick. It's a reference to a particular kind of fish that is engaged in mimicry, right? But you can fill in the details here. But the idea is that we are updating our assessment of, this actually kind of goes back to the first question. We're updating our assessment of somebody's mate value relative to what other people are assessing their mate value to be. So this is why women will ask their friends, oh, what do you think of this guy? Like, I met this new guy. What do you think? Do you think he's hot? They're calibrating whether they are properly rewarded by him or not relative to the consensus of the group, just in case they have any crazy distortion there. So it's a little bit of a comparison process that's going on. And in this case, it would be working in the sense that if there are a bunch of women kind of gathered together and some of them are hot and some of them are maybe less hot, it's worth approaching the whole group because the hot women are bringing up the average mate value of the whole collective. But yes. I can't remember the details about what kind of fish it is and where the original story comes from.
Thank you.
Yeah, it comes from a particular tropical fish off of Madagascar that... Yeah, so we'll talk about that another day. But it's basically, it's the notion of that, just think of the fish trick as two women in a bar and two women who are eights are sitting in a bar, and in walks a guy that one of them thinks is a 10 and the other one thinks he's an 8.5. And so the one who thinks is a 10 is instantly weak in the knees, and her brain is scrolling through the possibility of casual mating. And so she turns to her friend and says, "Wow, what do you think of that guy?" And her friend says, "Pretty good," but indicates that it's nothing to be weak knees over. What's going to happen inside the first woman's brain is, "Oh, I guess he's not actually a 10. Now, she's still very attracted to him, but her brain says, her brain makes a quick assessment by reducing her error in this decision by having polled another individual of the species and basically says, "Ooh, he must only be a 9. Okay, I must be subjectively overrating him." So it cools her jets a little bit, okay? And in doing so, reduces the odds of making an impulsive mistake, which would be to give up the eggs easily, etc., without scanning the interior of the thing too carefully, because we're so impressed by the paint job that it's worth it to get that paint into the next generation on top of our kid. Okay, so that's what's going on, and by checking, it cools her jets and says, "No, okay, all right, then now I need to see more before it's worth it." And that's the fish trick, and that has been found. That kind of use of another brain's assessment of a mate has been found in tropical fish. So if it's in the brains of tropical fish, female fish, looking at males and the stripes on their sides, which is exactly what was found here, then believe me, it's in humans. Humans wouldn't fail to use that same process. So we call it a trick because that's what we do in advertising. We pretend that, you know, 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Trident. Okay, so it's like, "Oh, well, it must be really good then." Okay, so in other words, we're acting like all the fish are going for this guy, even though they're not. But if we pretend we can trick somebody into thinking that there's a high value consensus, and that's what this is. That's what marketing is constantly trying to run fish tricks on humans to try to get them to overvalue a stimulus by pretending that there's a consensus.
Mm-hmm. And now if the male walks in and he looks just physically like a 7, for example, mm-hmm. but then he's got a female who's in the 90th percentile attractiveness, yes, on his arm. What does that do to the females watching him walk into the bar, to their psychology?
It will gives bump him up a little. It gives them pause. Right.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. What don't I know about this guy? Yes. What am I not immediately picking up? Like, yes, you know, he got her somehow. Did he hire her? Did he?
Yes.
Did he? You know, does he have a wonderful personality? Like, it might warrant a little more investigation than you would otherwise give him.
Yeah. Actually, it's been shown in with scientific investigation that the first inference that the females have in that situation is that he makes a lot of money. Yeah, which makes perfect sense. It's like, it's clearly she's not trading jeans for jeans. It's obvious she's trading down, so she must be getting a lot of resources or smelling a lot of resources, so that must be what it is. And that's inference number one. There would be others, but that's going to be the most prominent inference.
That's
yeah. There would be a lot of nuance, you know, with yes, with the presentation of the female too. Like if the female, you know, is sort of a more attractive, but has kind of a down to earth vibe, that might not be the first inference. It might be, oh, he's got a really great personality, or they, you know, that he's an Aquarius and she's a Leo, or you know, it's like. But if the female that he's with is extremely fancy, very dressed up, sort of flashing some bling herself, then that might absolutely be the first inference that women would make. So, yeah.
And if it's too big a discrepancy, you're right. They wonder if she's hired.
Oh, totally.
It would totally make sense. Yeah, sure.
Many. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Many a 25th reunion has had that situation.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.